If you look at any modern car, you are looking at a master class in material science that most people just completely overlook.
Oh,
We
absolutely.
need vehicles to be incredibly strong for safety, able to absorb massive amounts of crash energy, but they also had to be feather light, saving every possible gram for better fuel efficiency.
And that balance, strong and light, it isn't some kind of magic. It's all about the microscopic manipulation of steel.
The ultimate paradox,
It
Meredith.
is. And the difference between, say, a cheap, brittle piece of iron and a high-performance alloy comes down to how we precisely control its structure at high temperatures.
And that's what we're doing today. We are undertaking a deep dive into what is, it's truly a foundational text in modern metallurgy.
It is. It's a detailed technical thesis submitted to Cambridge back in 1980 by U.R. Lennell, and it focuses specifically on the reaustenitization of some alloy steels.
Okay, that's a mouthful. Let's unpack that term. Reaustenitization. Simply put, it's this absolutely crucial process of heating specific alloy steels back up.
To a very specific temperature range.
Exactly. To a point where their existing structure, which is usually a mix of soft ferrite and these tiny hard particles called carbides, starts to transform back into a high temperature phase called austenite.
And then you quench it, you cool it rapidly.
Right, and that rapid cooling essentially freezes that austenite into super hard materials like martensite.
And this process, it's not just academic, it's absolutely vital because it's the core heat treatment for creating materials the auto industry lives and dies by. Dual-phase steels or
You
DPS.
hear that term, DPS, all the time.
You do. And they're unique because their final microstructure is a composite.
Yeah.
It's a soft, flexible matrix of ferrite surrounding these hard, high-strength islands of martensite.
So if you're trying to stamp out a complex car door panel, you need that soft, formable ferrite. But once the car is built, you need the sheer strength of the martensite in a collision.
Exactly. That combination gives them superior strength and the formability they need. And our mission today is to look directly at this source material, this really heavy-duty science, and unpack the mechanics of it all.
The nucleation, the growth, the chemistry.
Yes, to understand exactly what controls the speed of these vital transformations.
And the study isn't just looking at one type of steel, right? It covers a pretty wide range.
That's right, it's comprehensive. It contrasts the behavior of low alloy steels, something like an iron manganese carbon system,
Okay.
with a high alloy steel, like an iron chromium carbon system with 10% chromium. A massive amount.
And to figure out what was happening, at that tiny microscopic level, they had to pull out some serious lab equipment.
They did. For the kinetics, the speed of the change, they use techniques like dilatometry.
Which is kind of like measuring the steel's pulse, isn't it?
That's a great way to think about it. As you heat it, the crystal structure changes and the volume changes just slightly. Measuring that tells you exactly when the transformation starts and stops. And they coupled that with high-resolution imaging using things like TEM, transmission electron microscopy, and EDAX, which lets you zoom in and chemically map the elements. It's a very, very thorough look.
Okay, let's start with the base ingredients. Before we even turn up the heat, what kind of microstructures were they dealing with?
Good question. Because the structure you start with, it dictates everything.
Right.
The research specified two main categories of starting materials. All of them had complex microstructures with carbides, which are just carbon atoms locked up in a crystal structure.
So for the low alloy stuff, we're talking pretty basic structures.
Yes. For those, they started with structures that were already processed. So you have ferrite with spheroidized cementite, where the carbon is in little spheres or structures that started out hard, like tempered martensite or bainite.
And that's the iron manganese carbon system. Now, what about the high alloy heavyweight, that Fe10CR system?
That was the iron chromium alloy. It started with ferrite and these very, very stable M-Euros type carbides. Yeah, and if you just think about that formula, 23 metal atoms for only 6 carbon atoms, you realize these are huge, complex cages of material, incredibly difficult to break apart.
But regardless of the starting shape, the industrial process they're modeling is intercritical annealing.
Exactly. That means heating the steel into that two-phase region where austenite and ferrite can coexist, holding it there for a bit, and then quenching.
And the goal is always the same.
Always, you have to carefully control how much austenite forms, because that austenite is what becomes your hard martensite islands when you cool it down.
What's really fascinating here is that the starting phase dictates how the new austenite even forms. You have to get the carbon out of those carbides first.
That's the key. That movement of carbon has to be immediate. The carbon needs to dissolve and then diffuse into the growing austenite.
Which is why the nucleation sites, the starting points, are so critical.
Absolutely. If your initial carbides are nicely spaced out, you get a good, even distribution of starting points. In those spheroidized structures, the austenite tends to kick off right at the carbide ferrite interfaces.
So the boundary, the line between the hard clump of carbon and the soft ferrite, that's the starting gun.
Precisely. In other structures, it might nucleate at grain boundaries or within perlite colonies. The takeaway is that the distribution of those initial carbides and boundaries is what determines how many austenite nuclei you get.
And more nuclei means finer, better martensite islands later on.
Exactly. A much more desirable final product.
We've established where the transformation starts. Now let's zoom in, way, way in, and watch the action at the atomic boundary.
Right at the interface.
Between the growing austenite and the ferrite around it. And this isn't some neat, smooth process. This is where it gets really interesting, because the shape of that growing phase is so important.
The shape, or the morphology, it tells you so much about the energy state of that boundary.
So what kind of shapes are we talking about?
Well, the research describes a few. You might see a relatively blocky, equiaxed growth. Think of like a rounded square. That's often found when it nucleates at grain boundaries, a pretty stable shape.
But then you get the really dramatic ones, the acicular or needle-like structures, or the Widmanstetten side plates.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of a needle growing into a solid, that sounds like a very aggressive, very fast transformation.
It is. And those tend to show up in coarser grained material, especially at higher temperatures. And what's key is that the crystallographic analysis ties the shape directly to the atomic structure.
How so?
The data shows that the growth of this austenite often follows what's called the Kerjamov-Sachs, or KS, orientation relationship with the ferrite grain next to it.
Kerjamov-Sachs. That sounds very specific. Why does that relationship matter if we're just talking about strength?
Because adopting that KS relationship allows the austenite to form low-energy, partially coherent interfaces.
Coherent interfaces.
Think of the crystal lattices of the ferrite and the austenite as two different, really complex Lego blocks. They don't fit perfectly, but the KS relationship shows you the exact alignment that lets them interlock with the least amount of strain and energy.
It creates an ordered, stable boundary.
Exactly. The most stable boundary possible.
Okay, that makes perfect sense for stability. But we also talked about chaos. If the KS relationship is the low-energy, stable path, why do we ever see those chaotic, unstable side plates?
Ah, and that is the critical challenge. This is where the source describes interfacial instability, especially in those spheroidized structures. It's a real aha moment.
An instability.
Yeah, it reveals this battle between order and speed. Like cliff face eroding, the solid interface can literally break down.
That's providing the pressure for it to break down.
It's the driving force for growth, and that's mainly the sheer speed of carbon diffusion.
Ah, the carbon again.
Always the carbon. The growing austenite needs carbon to survive and expand, so it creates this massive concentration gradient. The instability happens when that gradient is so powerful, when the austenite is demanding carbon so fast that it just overwhelms the surface energy of the interface.
So the interface can't hold its smooth, low-energy KS shape.
It can't. It starts to develop these perturbations, these chaotic protrusions you mentioned. The source has these incredible micrographs showing sharp protrusions, almost like little teeth breaking away from a smooth boundary.
So if the diffusion momentum is faster than the ability of the interface to kind of restructure itself into that perfect KS pattern, the whole thing just breaks down.
Precisely. It shows that high-energy interfaces are inherently unstable. It's a battle between crystalline order and diffusive momentum, and, you know, sometimes momentum just wins.
That structural battle is fascinating.
Yeah.
But what's more critical for the factory floor is, well, how fast it all happens.
Right.
Let's shift gears from the shape to the speed limit, the kinetics.
And this is where we go back to that F10% R alloy, because adding that much chromium, a big, slow-moving atom, it seriously complicates things. It forms those super stable carbides that act like roadblocks.
So tell us what the dielectrometry revealed when they started heating this alloy up.
It was crucial data. By tracking those length changes, they pinned down the transformation temperatures. The austenite start, or ACO, for the F10CR alloy was around 772 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
But the results revealed something really surprising. When they held the alloy at temperatures above that, The data suggested there were two distinct reactions happening one after the other.
Two reactions, not just one smooth transformation.
No, it's like a two-act play governed by diffusion.
Okay, so let's talk about the first act.
Act one is the quick start. The first reaction is the initial rapid formation of austenite. And this is controlled entirely by the supermobile carbon diffusion through the ferrite.
So carbon is the star of Act 1.
It is. Carbon is tiny, it's light, and it just zips through the structure, allowing the austenite to nucleate and start growing really aggressively.
And then Act 2 is where the real industrial headache starts.
Precisely. The second reaction is the dissolution of the remaining carbides inside that new austenite. And this step is controlled not by carbon, but by the much, much slower chromium diffusion.
Ah, the bottleneck.
The bottleneck. And the microanalysis proved it. Those M. urus carbides had concentrations of up to 79% chromium.
So carbon diffusion gets the party started when the austenite's ready to grow.
Yeah.
But the heavy, slow chromium diffusion determines when the party is actually over.
That's a perfect way to put it. The first rapid phase of austenite formation happens before any significant chromium partitioning is even detected. The problem is that dissolving those massive, stable, crow-rich carbides is incredibly slow. Chromium is the gatekeeper.
Why is it so much slower?
Well, because chromium is a substitutional element. It's sitting right on the metal crystal lattice point.
It's part of the main structure.
Exactly. So to move, it has to wait for a vacancy, an empty site, to open up, and then it moves slowly, one atom at a time. Carbon, being interstitial, just sneaks between the atoms much, much faster.
So if a manufacturer stops the heat treatment too soon,
the carbides are still there.
And that messes up the final quality of the steel.
Absolutely. The TTT curve, the time temperature transformation curve for this alloy shows the problem so clearly. The research had to label the timeline with two separate curves, one for austenite finish.
When the austenite is fully grown.
Right. And a separate, much later curve that represents complete carbide dissolution. You can have all the austenite you want, but if it's full of undissolved, Cree-rich carbides, the final strength and especially the ductility of your martensite will be compromised.
Which means, to get the purity you need, you have to wait for the slowest atom in the system, the chromium, to finally get a move on.
And the research shows you how to overcome it.
Wow.
You need a lot of heat. The source found that above 900 degrees Celsius, carbide dissolution happens really fast in less than 10 seconds. And this insight is critical for producing dual-phase steels. If the annealing treatment is too short or too cool, those carbides just act like impurities, and the final mechanical properties will suffer. It links the chemistry directly to the manufacturing window.
This has been a true deep dive. I mean, from the macroscopic need for lighter, stronger cars, all the way down to watching atoms move and clash.
It has.
And the key insight, really, is that re-austenitization is a dynamic competition. It's pitting the speed of mobile carbon, which dictates initial growth, against the lethargy of slow elements like chromium, which dictates when the job is actually done.
And that entire outcome is governed by these predictable processes. You have nucleation at carbide sites and growth that leads to these complex, sometimes unstable interfaces that are trying to follow that low-energy Kurjumov-Sachs relationship.
And the high-alloy steels confirm that critical two-step sequence. Carbon handles the quick start, mm-hmm. and chromium controls the final purity.
Right.
So for the metallurgist or the engineer listening, this research is basically the roadmap for optimizing the final product.
It is. It tells us that to get the best DPS microstructures, which need the most finely dispersed martensite islands,
yeah.
you have to optimize your starting structure. You want something like fine-grained ferrite, where your nucleation sites are spread out as evenly as possible.
And that ability to predict the outcome is what lets them tune the final property.
Exactly. The strength, the ductility, the formability.
Which brings us back to that huge time constraint.
Yeah.
The dissolution of those stable, rich carbides is a sluggish process.
It dominates the later stages of the heat treatment, and that's a problem when you're aiming for fast, cost-effective manufacturing.
So that raises a final provocative question for you, the listener.
Given how essential fast processing times are, and knowing we have these crystallographic relationships like KS and these specific diffusion kinetics, how can we design new alloy systems?
The systems where those stable, alloying, element-rich carbides dissolve even more rapidly.
Yeah, without having to jack the temperature up to 900 degrees. The future of high-strength steel depends on finding a clever way to speed up that chromium bottleneck without compromising the final structural integrity. That competition at the interface is definitely something to keep thinking about.